This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 13th of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, nuclear watchdogs call on federal regulators to improve safety at US reactors. Europe's debt crisis intensifies as the IMF asks Italy to implement austerity measures. And in Washington, Democratic lawmakers introduce legislation to increase transparency in corporate campaign spending.
So we've cut it way back. Shareholders really only get one vote. One vote a year to say you're allowed to set aside this pot of money to have a voice.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A string of bomb blasts in Mumbai, India has left dozens of commuters injured or dead. FSRN's Gayatri Lakshambai reports.
Three near simultaneous explosions rocked India's commercial capital of Mumbai on Wednesday afternoon. Government officials declared 21 people dead and 113 injured. However, reports suggest that the toll is likely to rise. The injured have been rushed to various public hospitals around the city. The blast took place in three crowded areas during evening rush hour as people were returning home from work. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack, but the government has released a statement pointing at a terror link. Anger is so far the most overt emotion among Mumbai's residents, who have witnessed more than six bomb blasts since 1993. The Home Minister has asked people to remain calm and maintain peace. Gayatri Lakshmibai, FSRN, Mumbai.
Last night in Cyprus, police arrested nearly two dozen people protesting a massive munitions explosion at a military base. The explosion killed 12 people and significantly damaged a power plant, according to Al Jazeera. Protesters say the explosion was caused by government negligence. Thousands of protesters marched on the presidential palace. Police used tear gas to subdue the crowd. Two high-ranking government officials have already resigned over the incident. In Philadelphia, the city's district attorney has filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court concerning the fate of Mumia Abu-Jamal. From Philadelphia, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted for murdering a police officer in 1981 and sentenced to death. After decades of legal battles, Abu-Jamal and his supporters successfully won a reprieve. Last April, a federal appeals court ruled Mumia Abu-Jamal's death sentence unconstitutional. But late last week, Philadelphia's district attorney sent an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The DA wants to keep Abu-Jamal on death row, even though Pennsylvania has only executed three prisoners since 1976. Earlier this year, Abu-Jamal successfully argued the jury was issued flawed instructions during his 1982 capital sentencing. At the time, jurors did not have to agree unanimously on mitigating circumstance during the sentencing phase. If they had, Abu-Jamal may have avoided death row. A spokesperson from Abu-Jamal's legal team told FSRN they will not comment while the Supreme Court is considering the latest lower court ruling. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
Today, the U.S. House passed legislation that would strip the EPA's authority to enforce the Clean Water Act. The mining industry is supporting the legislation, but the industry is coming under new fire today from scientists and activists. They are citing a new study linking mountaintop removal mining to birth defects. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Maria Gano of West Virginia has been speaking at events across the country to raise awareness about the effects of mining on her community.
We appeal to the nation to intervene and bring an end to the staggering human cost and mounting death toll from one of the most egregious health and civil rights violations in our lifetimes.
Environmental advocates have long cited high cancer rates and respiratory issues in mining communities, but new research shows significantly more birth defects in areas with mountaintop removal. The University of West Virginia study, published in the Journal of Environmental Research, says the results were conclusive, even when they controlled for smoking and drinking during pregnancy, the age of the mother, race, and ethnicity. In light of this new information, Gano and other activists want a moratorium on mountaintop removal until the Center for Disease Control investigates the damages to public health. One of their supporters, Kentucky Democrat John Yarmuth, is sponsoring the Clean Water Protection Act. The legislation would strengthen the Clean Water Act to prevent the dumping of mountaintop removal mining waste into local waters. But that legislation has not yet made it to the House floor. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
And finally, the FIFA Women's World Cup continues today in Germany. Japan is playing Sweden, and the U.S. has already defeated France in their bids to make the finals this Sunday. As the competition takes place on the field, activists are protesting the lack of official action against the Nigerian head coach. Under the coach, Ucharia Uche, several lesbian players have been kicked off the Nigerian national team. The website, allout.org, has collected more than 45,000 signatures urging action by FIFA, and a flash mob protest has been reportedly planned outside the stadium today. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Japan today, the Prime Minister Naoto Kan announced that his country should become a nuclear-free society. It's the strongest anti-nuclear statement yet from the unpopular Prime Minister as his administration continues to struggle with the ongoing crisis at the Fukushima nuclear plant. The crisis has prompted many countries to review their nuclear energy plants, including the United States. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Japan Task Force issued recommendations to improve plant safety at more than 100 reactors across the U.S. The task force recommends improving safeguards designed to deal with station blackouts, earthquakes, flooding, and spent fuel pools. The watchdog group Union of Concerned Scientists issued their own list of more than 24 recommendations in response. At a teleconference, UCS nuclear expert David Lockbaum said the NRC should require nuclear plants to move spent fuel from wet pool storage to dry casks. The overheating of the spent fuel pools was a major factor in Japan's nuclear disaster.
The NRC's recommendations 7.1 through 7.5 address spent fuel pool concerns, but don't advocate the transfer of irradiated fuel into dry casks. Thus, the NRC's proposed actions, while good, remain insufficient to responsibly handle this known hazard.
The UCS also wants new reactors to be safer than existing ones and resistant to terrorist attacks. Nuclear expert Dr. Edwin Lyman also wants U.S. reactors to be able to withstand a Fukushima-style disaster.
Stands to reason that if we're going to be building new nuclear reactors in this country that will be around for 60 or 80 years, that they should be built to the highest safety standards. However, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a long-standing policy that new reactors do not have to be safer than existing reactors, although they would like them to be safer, but they refuse to actually require them to be safer. And as a result, the U.S. is getting exactly what we've asked for, which is a fleet of new reactor designs, none of which actually demonstrate significantly enhanced safety.
The NRC commissioners are due to discuss the nuclear report in a public briefing on July the 19th. Democratic lawmakers introduced legislation today that would enable shareholders to have a say in where their money is spent. As Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, the bill's proponents say it's needed to combat a Supreme Court ruling that gives undue advantage to corporations.
No one denies the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling brought drastic changes to campaign finance laws. The debate is over whether allowing corporations to have the same rights as citizens is a good or a bad thing. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez says the ruling to allow companies to spend limitless amounts of cash on campaigns has had a negative impact on democracy.
With this decision, big oil and big business and even foreign corporations with foreign government control have undue influence over the electoral process.
Watchdog groups report the 2010 midterm election witnessed four times as much outside spending as the last midterm election in 2006. Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen says the 2010 election also broke another record.
This is the first time ever that a midterm election eclipsed a general election when it comes to outside spending. And the ads that were funded by these unaccountable corporate interests fueled massive attacks, which truly shaped the election cycle.
In the latest attempt to curtail the Citizens United ruling, a group of Democratic lawmakers, including Menendez, have introduced the Shareholder Protection Act. It would require corporations to hold shareholder votes on political expenditures annually. The idea is simple. Corporate campaign spending involves shareholders' money, so let them decide if they want it to go to candidates or not. Menendez says corporate spending is more than just politics on the campaign trail. It follows lawmakers to the halls of Congress.
It is, in my mind, fundamentally wrong that corporate entities, and particularly even those with foreign influence, can make decisions on U.S. policy, which is ultimately what elections are all about. Not only who will be elected to those positions, but what those individuals will promote.
Republicans have largely opposed measures attempting to change the Supreme Court ruling, and Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn says he doubts this effort will succeed.
I don't think it's going to go very far because basically our Democratic friends are now doing the same thing that they excoriated Republicans for in terms of advocacy, advertising.
Cornyn accuses Democrats of trying to silence the democratic process through tamping out rights the high court deemed constitutional.
And I think the principle is that there ought to be a freedom of speech, including political speech. And so efforts to squelch political speech, obviously there's constitutional problems with that. So that's why I think the Supreme Court was correct.
Democrats counter that their latest effort isn't intended to subvert the Supreme Court's ruling. Rather, California Democratic Congressperson Anna Eshoo says it's all about transparency.
So I think that we make an important investment when we have a public policy in our country that there is an openness and a disclosure. This does not infringe in any way constitutionally. It simply means that the public knows.
Sponsors of the legislation also say they've tried to meet critics of their effort halfway. Massachusetts Democratic Congressperson Michael Capuana says at first they considered having shareholders vote on every donation, but now it's an annual vote.
So we've cut it way back. Shareholders really only get one vote. One vote a year to say you're allowed to set aside this pot of money to have a voice.
The newly introduced bill would also require corporations to file all their expenditures on the Securities and Exchange Commission's website so that the public could see the issues and the candidates the company is trying to influence. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Today, the International Monetary Fund called on Italy to ensure decisive implementation of spending cuts to reduce its debt. There are now rising concerns among financial experts that Italy may be the next victim of the Eurozone's debt crisis, but some see Italy's economy as too big to bail out. Meanwhile, in Greece, the finance minister has said his country needs a second loan on top of the current EU-IMF rescue deal worth more than $150 billion. For more, we're joined by Andrew Watt, senior researcher at the European Trade Union Institute in Brussels. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
How serious is the economic situation in Italy, and how likely is it that Italy could be next in line for a bailout?
Well, I'm very concerned because the economic crisis, specifically the sovereign debt crisis, started here with Greece and last year, and since then it's been spreading across the periphery of the euro area, hitting Ireland and Portugal. And now, very likely, Italy and Spain are in the headlights of the financial markets. They're concerned, and that is pushing up the interest rates on Italian sovereign debt and also Spanish sovereign debt. And the worry is that this is going to be a sort of self-perpetuating vicious circle that we've seen in other countries, and that in the end, Italy will also need some form of external support, a bailout.
You've written that if the EU attempts to bail out Italy, the whole edifice would surely collapse. What did you mean exactly?
Well, indeed, I mean you have to see the relative dimensions of the problem. I mean, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal together only represent 6% of the output of the GDP of the euro area. So, although the numbers are in the billions. To be honest with you, this is actually, in economic terms, small change, right? I mean, I don't know exactly what federal states of the U.S. would constitute 6% of the total GDP, but you can probably know that better than I do. But it would be a couple of smaller states, right? The problem is that Italy is not quite California, but it's about 16% of the euro area, and it also its debts are well above 100% of its GDP. So that means its debt as a percentage of the euro area's GDP, we're talking about, you know, getting close towards 20%, right? And this is really too much. It'll be very difficult for the euro area governments to bail Greece out.
Is it possible to specify what exactly has changed in Italy's economy in recent weeks, or is it just sort of spreading general concern about what's happening in Greece and maybe Italy's next?
Well, I think one thing we've learned from the economic crisis more generally since 2008 is how irrational financial markets can be, and they're driven by herd behavior that it's very hard to understand. I mean, people have been pointing for some time already to the risk factors, the fact that its debt levels are high, notably, and the fact that its growth is very sluggish. There were rumors in the press that Berlusconi, the prime minister, wanted to dismiss the finance minister, who's quite well respected. This may have been what spooked the markets, but in the end, one doesn't know. But basically, it was an accident waiting to happen.
Greece is now asking for a second loan. What does that say about the success of this first loan worth many billions that's in play already?
Well, it says that the first loan was not a success at all. It was a failure, quite frankly. This was a failure that I and other progressive economists in Europe and to some extent also in the US predicted. If you looked at the debt levels, if you looked at the rate of growth that we can expect in Greece in the coming years, and you looked at the interest rates that the Greeks were being obliged to pay by the European Union and by the International Monetary Fund, then it was actually fairly obvious that this was not going to work. That the only way to try and make it work, which is what the Greeks exactly did, was really to slash everything, to cut spending, to raise taxes, and it was obvious that was actually going to depress Greek growth. This is precisely what's happened, and so it's in that sense no surprise.
There's speculation that some European countries might pull out of the common currency. Is that a possibility, and what impact would that have?
Well, that is a very difficult question. Constitutional lawyers here say that there is absolutely no provision to leave the euro area. In pure legal terms, once you're in, at least as a member of the European Union. So some lawyers are saying that if a country were to leave the euro area, it would also have to leave the European Union. Now, I mean, you know, we're obviously in totally uncharted waters here. Some progressive economists have actually recommended that Greece leave the euro area because it then will be able to devalue its currency and regain competitiveness. I am really actually, you know, very worried about this. This could even be enough to tip not just Europe, but also the rest of the world into a renewed recession.
The IMF-EU approach to these debt problems in Ireland, Portugal and Greece has been lots of financial help in exchange for tough austerity packages in these countries. What alternatives would you and progressive economists like European leaders to be looking at?
Well, I mean, the first thing is to get the price of debt down. I mean, the problem is that Greece cannot possibly, and the other countries too, cannot possibly service their debts if they're paying the sort of market interest rates now, which are in some cases up around 12%. This is just not possible. And the interest rates demanded by the EU and IMF were also excessive of the order of 6%. So the main thing is to get interest rates down to the same level that other European countries can borrow at. Germany and other countries can borrow money at just above 3%. So why not take that money, lend it on to Greece at the same rate of interest, and that would make in itself a huge contribution to resolving the problems.
Andrew Watts, senior researcher at the European Trade Union Institute in Brussels, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your interest.
In California, prison inmates are in the 12th day of a hunger strike. Prisoners in the isolation wing of the high-security Pelican Bay Jail are refusing meals and water to protest what they say are inhumane conditions. The strike has spread to at least six other prisons. Tina Busherman reports.
More than 1,000 prisoners started the hunger strike on July 1st at Pelican Bay's security housing unit known as the SHU. About 200 continue the hunger strike. Many of the prisoners have pre-existing medical conditions, and activists say the health of some is deteriorating to critical levels. Linda Evans is an organizer with All or None, an advocacy group for formerly incarcerated individuals. At a press conference, she read part of a letter from a nurse who works in the prison's security housing unit.
They are not drinking water and have decompensated rapidly. Some are in renal failure and have been unable to make urine. Some are having measured blood sugars in the 30 range, which can be fatal if not treated. They've refused concentrated sugar packs and Ensure. The staff has taken them to the clinic and given them intravenous glucose when allowed by the prisoners, but most will not accept this medical support.
In a statement, one prisoner said this form of peaceful protest was their only option to change conditions, and that a core group was, quote, committed to taking this all the way to the death if necessary. California prison spokesperson Terry Thornton said they are providing the hunger strikers with medical care.
We have had just a handful of inmates who've had to receive some hydration therapy because they were dehydrated. At this point, there are no incidents or medical occurrences of inmates in distress.
California's prison system has a long history of problems. Earlier this year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that overcrowding constituted cruel and unusual punishment. A ruling in 2001 described the prison's medical system as broken beyond repair and also in violation of the Eighth Amendment. Again, Linda Evans.
Well, the prison medical staff never believes the prisoners, you know. None of the administrative staff, medical staff, they always feel like people are pretending or faking. And, you know, the medical care at Pelican Bay is just absolutely atrocious.
Prisoners also want an end to Pelican Bay's debriefing policy. They say prison administration uses the debriefing policy to force them to name themselves or others as gang members, and they use access to food, medication, or further isolation in the SHU as a threat. They also want an end to 23-hour-a-day isolation in windowless, soundproof cells. Carol Strickman is staff attorney with Legal Services for Prisoners with Children and a legal representative of the Prisoner Hunger Strike Coalition. She says they're pressing for dialogue with prison officials.
I think the mediation team that we've put together would concur that there have been no negotiations. There have been conversations. The mediation team would like to get it off conversations and into negotiations as rapidly as possible. We don't know whether or not that's going to be possible.
California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation administrators say they're not willing to negotiate, but spokesperson Thornton claims they are in dialogue with the hunger strikers.
We have sent management teams to Pelican Bay State Prison. They talk to the inmates. Actually, the inmates didn't have a whole lot to say to them, unfortunately. We have our ombudsman's office, who is maintaining dialogue. We have chaplains, we have custody staff, medical staff, wardens are making rounds as well, speaking with the inmates. They have been much dialogue.
Advocates say prisoners have submitted formal complaints to the warden, Governor Jerry Brown, and the Corrections Department secretary. While the prisoners wait for a response to their demands, activist Linda Evans says they continue to help spread the word about this protest.
Communication is very, very difficult. That's one of the first things that they shut down inside any prison system when there's an effort at resistance. There has been time for information to come to the outside and then go back in through prisoner newsletters, through letters from family members, through communications with lawyers.
What began as a hunger strike among inmates of the isolation unit of Pelican Bay Prison has turned into a statewide display of solidarity. Officials say that statewide, 800 inmates at six institutions are refusing their state-issued food. That number peaked over the 4th of July weekend at an estimated 6,600 inmates. Tina Boschman, FSRN.
In Wisconsin, 9 state senators, 6 Republicans, and 3 Democrats are running in recall elections this summer as a result of public outrage over their votes on a bill to strip public workers of their unions. Tuesday saw the first round of primaries in the state. From Baraboo, Wisconsin, Molly Stentz has more.
In each of the six races to recall the Republican senator, the GOP put up a protest candidate to force the Democratic challenger to a primary race. This drags out the race, giving candidates more time to raise money, and also forces the challenger to spend money on an extra race. But Democrats handily defeated the protest candidates in all six districts on Tuesday. Baraboo is currently represented by Senator Luther Olson, a moderate Republican. As a result of Tuesday's primary, he'll now face Democratic State Representative Fred Clark in a general election on August 9th. Like many voters across the state, those in the central Wisconsin city of Baraboo did not turn out in droves for this unusual election. Turnout was 7% countywide, much lower than a typical spring election for local candidates. Not all voters saw a need for recall elections. Many in Baraboo expressed disappointment that the state would spend money to hold elections in times of tight budgets. Some, like Ralph Kranick of Baraboo, called it a waste.
Well, I think they're a total waste of time and waste of money. And I think the Milwaukee Journal just last Sunday had an excellent editorial on this, that recall elections should be reserved not for policy votes, but for malfeasance or wrongdoing on the part of a legislator while in office. And they just said that this is just costing unprecedented amounts of money, and it's causing further divisions in the electorate.
But other voters, including high school English teacher Bill Schlewy, said the recalls were a necessary way for voters to hold their elected officials accountable.
I came out to vote today. First of all, after the events of the previous 6 months or 7 months now, I guess you would say, it's quite obvious that the state's not headed in the direction that I think we should head in. And Luther Olson was a big part of that. He just rubber stamped what the governor wanted. And this is the first step in removing him from office. I did have to actually chuckle, though, at the fact that I'm going to have to vote twice for Fred Clark, simply because they had to put a protest candidate up for a party that says they're concerned about money. Why make me vote twice?
Another voter, Bill Smith of Baraboo, did not favor the recall election or either challenger, but said it was his civic duty to vote. He wanted to register his disapproval of Senator Olson and the state GOP.
Olson is a disaster. Let me put it this way. One of the fundamental problems for the Republicans here and in Washington is that they have an idea that somehow government should be run like a business. And government is not a business. Government is a trust. Okay?
Next Tuesday will bring recall elections for three Democratic senators. In two races, there will be a primary between Republican challengers for the seat. In the third race, between Senator Dave Hansen of Green Bay and Republican challenger David Vanderleest, voters will cast decisive ballots next week. The general election for the recall of six Senate Republicans is in 3 weeks. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Baraboo, Wisconsin.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. We'll be right back.